your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, May 25th, 2025, as we record this new episode. We hope that you are having a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. The White Sox have an afternoon game in Queens on Memorial Day against the New York Mets. We'll preview that series later in the show as the White Sox face one of the best teams in Major League Baseball. But the White Sox picked up another series win against the Texas Rangers. They had a good shot of sweeping them, but they blew another ninth inning lead. The White Sox are now 17-36. They're on pace to win 52 games in 2025. That would be an 11-game improvement from last year. For those following along with the steak dinner bet, the White Sox are on pace to score 556 runs, which is a half run more than the preseason line Beefloaf and I set for the bet. That seems to be in line with how many of us viewed this 2025 season for the White Sox, but there's been some unpleasant surprises. Luis Robert Jr. struggling has made an impact, but he did have a good weekend against the Rangers. Then there's the downfall of Andrew Vaughn. Biggest news this weekend was the Chicago White Sox optioning not only Tim Elko to Charlotte, but also Andrew Vaughn. In a previous podcast episode, I advocated for Vaughn to be optioned again because he's at negative 1.3 war. Optioning both first basemen while reactivating Andrew Benintendi and Mike Tauchman was a curious decision by general manager Chris Getz. That means more time at first base for Miguel Vargas, who was worth negative 2 outs above average. Really, he's 2 runs below league average compared to other third basemen in the major leagues. Vargas in particular gets dinged moving to his right towards the foul line. Also, Lenin Sosa will get time at first base, but he had a mental lapse on Sunday in the ninth inning when he got lost in positioning and missed first base by plenty. So first base is going to be a position to watch these next few weeks. Here's Getz on why he made the decision to option both Vaughn and Elko.
With Vaughn and Elko going down, this is not necessarily an indictment on them. You know, there's always things that need to be worked on, but an opportunity to maintain depth, you know, balance our lineup, and perhaps get a tick more versatile defensively. When it comes to, you know, Vaughn, obviously he's been grinding. He has, you know, we had a discussion yesterday, and, you know, there's a point in a lot of players' careers where, you know, you're better off going down to AAA for a little bit, you know, really starting to almost focus on reclaiming who you are as a player, as a hitter. You know, we've seen him dangerous before in the box, and we want to get him back to that. In regards to sending Elko down, you know, he had some big homers for us. You know, we certainly expect him back, but we opted to you know, balance out the lineup, do a little bit more things defensively, and maintain the depth for the remainder of the season. But we do expect both those guys back at some point.
Getz was also asked why he felt the timing was now to option Andrew Vaughn.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the underlying work that he's done, I mean, there's a little bit of unluckiness in his game. You know, he would square up the ball, you know, from time to time and get hits, get big hits. You know, I think at this point, though, you know, we can't just rely on the expected numbers. I think, the level of production that we need to see out of him and that position needs to be better. And so, you know, there's some physical adjustments that can be made, and you know, we're going to dive into that.
Getz also shared what adjustments the White Sox need to see from Vaughn while he's in Charlotte.
There are some mechanical adjustments that can be made. You know, the sinking up his lower half and upper half. You know, he was a guy that, you know, early on, you know, although maybe he wasn't getting hits, he was making good decisions at the plate, seeing the ball well, taking his walks. And, you know, some of that is putting your body in a position to make quality decisions. So this game will speed you up for a lot of different reasons because of, you know, the talent of the pitching, just the overall talent of the major league level. So to go down and play against this type of competition in a different environment can really allow you to make those adjustments, because you put so much pressure on yourself as a hitter to be productive, and sometimes the harder you try, can be a detriment. So at this point, we felt like it was necessary to go down there, but we still believe in Andrew Vaughn, and you know, he knows he can be a productive major league player, and I imagine he's going to take advantage of this.
White Sox manager Will Venable shared his thoughts about Vaughn's demotion to AAA, stating that there's no set timetable for his return to the majors.
No, I think, you know, you go down there with a plan as far as the things that you want to work on and clean up, build that plan and go out and try and execute it. But I don't think putting kind of a time frame on it is useful, and it's not something that we did.
Venable was also asked if the clubhouse dynamic will be impacted not seeing Vaughn there every game.
It'll be different, but this is part of it. I think, you point to guys across the league that have done it. Jake Berger is a good friend of his who just did it, which I think is helpful for Vonnie to have somebody that has just had a positive experience with it. For him to go do it gives him optimism that it is possible and a productive thing, which it is. So, I think it's a new thing, but this game throws a lot of challenging things at you, and I know Vonnie will be able to handle it.
Joining me now to ponder what's next at first base for the White Sox, recap the White Sox series win against the Texas Rangers, and review the upcoming New York Mets series are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. Hello, gentlemen. And they did it. I didn't think they had it in them, but the White Sox option Andrew Vaughn. We just heard from both Chris Getz and Will Venable about the situation. James, from what you are hearing at the stadium and in the clubhouses, do you have any insight on how long of a stint this could be for Andrew Vaughn in AAA or even Tim Elko?
It definitely, the messaging was that Vaughn would be back soon. I wouldn't think they would need a prolonged run of looking good to do it, but obviously he does have to look good, and we've been waiting for him to look good all season, and that hasn't happened yet, and he didn't exactly just like go down there and mash like three home runs right away or anything like that. So at the same time, they clearly feel like their roster is a bit more versatile without him. Obviously, to some of that rests in the idea that Lenny Sosa can play first base and be normal, which we'll see on that one. But as far as like matching up, being platoon wise and doing all the sort of like super active things that Venable's often doing, I think there probably is a bit more flexibility or movability. It certainly makes Andrew Benintendi be the DH all the time something they can do, if only because they have six outfielders, and how else do you just make this work at all without it? But as far as like having kind of a host of multi-positional gloves with Rojas and Sosa and the different handedness, like, and if like any arrangement that leads to like Vinny Capra like literally playing it all, which it isn't necessarily an organizational priority, but a curiosity of like how little someone can play on the roster. It's clear, like, you know, I think if you wanted to take like a super pointed interpretation of Will Venable's like post-game comments Friday that he certainly did not mean, it's like him saying like, man, we're able to execute a game plan like 1 through 9, like everyone doing what they're supposed to in any given at bats, which, you know, it's not like Vaughn was going off book, but is certainly when he's not going well, is someone who's very aggressive and can hit a lot of stuff in the ground that's unproductive or kind of ruinous sort of contact in search of like the hard contact, like extra base hit that he's supposed to deliver, and not necessarily someone who's supposed to think about, oh, I've got a bunt or hit directionally. He's supposed to be your big bop in the lineup. Mm-hmm. But if he's just going and grounded into really hard double plays like all the time, he's not fitting into the game plan the way that maybe your sort of more versatile bats are. I think they're certainly not going to ignore Vaughn getting hot at a level that he should get hot at some point, but it also doesn't seem like, oh, our roster's just broken without him, like we gotta rearrange everything, we don't want to live this way where we're putting plus defenders in every position. When can he get back? Like there's not that, but, and that kind of speaks to just like him not necessarily fitting in like with the long-term, what they'll do on the diamond. But I think if, you know, he is 2 weeks and he's 1,000 OPS, he'll be right back. which I probably could have just said and made this a shorter segment, but there'd be less color.
Well, I appreciate the color. Jim, Lenin Sosa, let's talk about that costly mistake on Sunday. Didn't cover first. I think based on replays, he was lost. Like, oh no, where am I on the field?
Mm-hmm.
And that run, unfortunately, that did reach safely was the difference as the White Sox lost 5-4 on Sunday. I'm not expecting Lenin Sosa to get a long run at first base. Are we going to see then more Miguel Vargas at first instead of third?
It might seem so, although with Sosa hitting fairly well, I think that's a tricky part. Like, he's hitting well enough to play somewhere, and the White Sox don't have all positions accounted for, because like if he's not playing first, he's playing second, assuming Benintendi is DHing, which it seems like he's going to do. So, you know, he's got a bat that's playing enough to where like this team, they don't have to play him somewhere, but they're inspired to do so. So that leaves like second or first. And you would think first would be the simplest place to play him because it has like the fewest moving parts. You know, we saw him earlier in the series misstepping on second base, taking like a lead runner out, and instead like aborting mission and throwing to first, and then all of a sudden you have two runners in scoring position. And then you factor in this play where he's just not covering first. And like, that's probably, you know, it's very easy to oversimplify defensive execution and say, well, you know, we are taught in Little League to do this. But like in first base, like that's very much a case of where do you go with the ball if it's hit you? Where do you go with the ball if it's somewhere else? And in this case, like it's more complicated at the major league level because the cutoffs are different, everything like that. But in the case of this one, it's like if it's hit to me, you know, field it. If it's not, go to first base on the ground. In this case, like no matter what Miguel Vargas was going to do, whether go home, if he got a clean handle on it, or go to first, like either way, his responsibility is once the ball is on the ground to the left side is to report to first base. And he did not do that. And so that's, I think, where it's a case of it's very, I think, black and white or stark with the issue, which is that he gets lost in the field, and it almost seems like a distraction type thing. And, you know, it's very, you get into armchair diagnoses, which I don't like doing, but ever since the White Sox didn't take Reynaldo Lopez seriously about focus issues and then realized like he couldn't see, does make you wonder, or, you know, just, it's worth throwing out there at the very least, like whether the White Sox have done like, I don't know, like just, yeah, there are a lot of players who have, you know, ADHD medications and such. And, you know, that's been in terms of like performance enhancing and so forth. But just, that's really like the only thing when in terms of like two games in a row, just like getting distracted or like having his order of operations overwritten by something he didn't expect to happen. And when that's happening and you're not able to make even like the less complicated decisions at first base, it does really reduce the amount of positions you can play without just giving in and saying, yeah, this guy just might do weird things and you just have to live with it. And sometimes you can live with it if they're hitting well enough to where like you're talking about a silver slugger in the, like, you know, watching Adam Dunn try to play the outfield. That was a case of like, yeah, you know, he's not going to be able to do it, but he's hitting 40 plus homers a year. He's got to play somewhere. So left field it is. Like that's, that was one case where you just had to accept the foibles that went along with it. But if he's not hitting 20 homers, then you have to have a more complicated conversation or just hope that like Colson Montgomery continues to be fixed and then he makes things a lot simpler. So, you know, maybe the earlier or the easier replacement is right around the corner. But right now, I think it just is uncomfortable. What do we do with this guy?
To add a note, like Venable indicated that it was going to be platoon oriented, like the first base usage that against right-handed starters, they want to work Rojas in. So that's what pushes Vargas to first. And, you know, they don't want to play Rojas against lefties. And that's where Sosa's first base reps are supposed to come. Tice took some reps out there one day. I assume that it had some reason for snapping it out of the strict platoon, whether it's just, you know, performance reasons or injuries or Sosa being weird too much. But that is mostly supposed to be a lefty-righty split between Vargas and Sosa at first, from initial indications.
To Jim's point about the hitting, in his last seven games, Lenin Sosa's 8-for-18. And as James has pointed out multiple times in this podcast in recent weeks, Lenin Sosa leads the White Sox in hits. So, yeah, the White Sox, Will Venable, lacking above league average hitters, needs Lenin Sosa in the lineup. I get that. And you really do need Andrew Benintendi as your DH because he is a bad left fielder. I get that. It's going to get weird. First base is going to get weird in the next couple of weeks. I'm surprised that Chris Getz optioned both Tim Elko and Andrew Vaughn, but I understand why he optioned both Tim Elko and Andrew Vaughn. The good news, though, with Vaughn and Elko going to Charlotte, didn't really impact the White Sox on the field all that much because they won a series against the Texas Rangers. They had an excellent chance of sweeping the Rangers, as I mentioned in the intro, but they blew another ninth inning lead. And James, the veterans are back. The vets are back. Andrew Benintendi, Austin Slater, and Mike Tauchman. Tauchman and Slater both hit home runs in the series. Is it safe to assume that these three are going to be everyday players or close to everyday players until the trade deadline?
Slater, I would downgrade a bit because like he's the short side of a platoon. I don't think they're like never play him against righties ever. And they certainly like his defense is good enough that he doesn't get like played off the field for defensive substitutions, even if I think he ranks below seemingly definitely Taylor. And, you know, him and Tauchman never really have, I guess, a reason for there to be directly competing. But initial indications is that they rate Tauchman a little higher defensively than Slater. So he doesn't merit, a defensive sub replacement, but he's a short side of the platoon. So you could easily go like a series without seeing him get a start. At the same time, like Venable kind of does hockey subs to some degree, like with his bench. Notably not the case today against a lefty starter, and he had so many just kind of like lefties and then another lefty closer where they didn't really empty it. But being a short side of platoon guy, as you can see with Michael Taylor, especially if you can defend your spot, is not as much of like a sentence to not playing as it might be with teams where the talent keeps you off the field a bit more if you're on the bench.
And then Jim, Luis Robert, he went 4-for-11 in this series against the Rangers with 3 RBIs. And also 3 stolen bases. Luis Robert has already reached 20 stolen bases on the season. He does lead the majors in that category. Are we reversing course now from our panic state in our previous podcast episode on Thursday?
I'm going to just, from here on out, just be ambivalent.
Always be in panic
state. Yeah, or not panic state, but just neither. Neither panicked nor encouraged. I think I'm just going to be numb to what Luis Robert does in a given week. You know, maybe I'll revisit it on a monthly basis, but he is the most talented player the White Sox have, and occasionally that should show. And so, like, that's, I don't know whether this is a case of the start of an upswing or just, you know, he got some hits to fall, and when that happens and he gets on base alongside, you know, legitimate contact being rewarded, it should be a good time had by all. So I think, yeah, there is... with Robert doing a better job of discerning balls from strikes and still being healthy, talented, fast, etc., he should have weekends where it all comes together and everybody should feel good no matter what. Like, he's been so underperforming his physical skill set that regression should help him out at some point. So, you know, just a matter of like whether this is just he needs more than regression to come back. Like, he needs a legitimate heater. So that's where I'm not optimistic, but like, I would be a lot more worried if he couldn't run or if he were swinging with one hand like he was a couple of years ago when we've seen him in a compromised state. So, yeah, hopefully it's just a matter of, you know, equilibrium being very difficult for him to accomplish, but he's fine. And so, like, yeah, seeing him run the bases and leading the league in stolen bases, I think, is still my leading indicator of, like, there should be better here, but whether it'll show up in time for it to manifest in trade value as something where, like, I need to see it to believe it at this point.
And then Sean Berg, he bounced back nicely against the Rangers. He had a difficult first inning. He walked 2 batters, but he was able to get through 6 innings. He only walked 3 in that start. So from innings 2 through 5, he only walked 1 batter. So he got his walks under control. James, what worked for Sean Burke? What did he tell you post game to make that adjustment and look a lot better than his previous 3 starts?
I mean, for him, I at the at the dangerous risk of saying the most generic thing possible, fastball command is key, I believe, for Sean Burke. Unique among pitchers, I believe, in this, how much it affects them. But he is more fastball heavy than all their other starters, who all of them are most like, what's the bare minimum number of fastballs I can throw to get out of here today mindset. Whereas for him, it's something that's big that's finishing up top. But another thing he said he's been tapping into more is, he throws so many breaking balls, so many like chase breaking balls in the dirt, that if he can occasionally pipe in that like fastball at the knees for hitters who are kind of like, that's low, this guy is either throwing high fastballs or spiking breaking balls, I'm ignoring everything that's not built up. If he can dot some of those per game, he feels like that makes him a lot more viable, especially early on. And that is hopefully a use that his sinker that you see him sprinkle in more and more can fulfill from it, helping him hit those spots more than his four-seamer would. So that's kind of what he was buzzing off of last time out. Obviously, there's still a bit more control hiccups than you want. He's scheduled for Wednesday against New York, which would have a lot of lefties as a challenge for him. But there is a little mystery with Jonathan Cannon saying he's felt great Sunday and talking like he expects to pitch in New York. I think Burke would be the most likely person, both on schedule-wise and arsenal-wise, that you would say, okay, let's push him to Baltimore, see how that goes for him. So that could be an element for him dictating his week as much as anything.
I mean, Sean Burke did pitch his college baseball with Maryland, so it'd be kind of a homecoming a little bit for Sean Burke if they did do that. Burke went 6 innings, allowed just 3 hits, 1 earned run against the Rangers. Again, walking 3, but striking out 6. A nice bounce back start from Sean Burke against the Rangers over the weekend. A pitching performance that didn't go so well, Jim. And this is where a lot of White Sox fans, especially on social media Sunday night, pulling their hair a little bit. And it's the bullpen experience, specifically the Jordan Leisure closing experience, wasn't fun. Do you agree with Will Venable's approach, where right now he seems to be having a rotation of guys trying to close out games? We saw Steven Wilson close out a game and pick up a save for the White Sox recently. Do you like that idea of rotating guys around, Jim? Or would you prefer that Venable just picked one pitcher, a dedicated person trying to close, even though there might not be anyone currently in the bullpen that has closer material?
I don't dislike it, I guess, what I'll say. Like, I don't know if I like anything about this bullpen really that would get me thinking that there's like a better option than what he's doing. Probably in terms of stuff and consistency, or like when the stuff is good, it plays, it overpowers. I would guess that Cam Boozer is maybe like the most closer like pitcher they have, but you know, he's a lefty and sometimes it doesn't match up well. And also he, you know, when it goes wrong, it goes wrong. Like he's had scoreless outings, then he's had disasters. And so enough to where, you know, you might have to use him in an inning earlier to face lefties, to get tough lefties out. And that's understandable. Like, this bullpen is not so good that if the White Sox have to nurse a one-run lead across 3 innings, that they can afford to save their best, what they feel like is their best reliever for the very end. They need outs first, and that's kind of been working for them until it doesn't. But yeah, I think just, you know, Wilson got into a home run problem, so he's not perfect. Leisure has, when he makes mistakes, they seem like they're very hittable, so he's not great. So I think there is probably safety in numbers in the sense of just not being able to, for fans, or even, you know, maybe it's even like, you don't even have to invoke the fans at this point, because, you know, player confidence is, you know, they're judging results. Like, even if there weren't fans to boo or be disgruntled or threaten them on social media, they would still be a case of like, oh, they're not happy with what they're doing. They're all being asked to pitch above their pay grade. And so when you look at it that way, and they've tried Leisure, I think, enough times to think like, he's gonna have to prove it, I think, over the course of, you know, maybe a month to show that like he's gonna be a future closer, like that his stuff is, yeah, you know, he's got 2+ pitches enough to get through the highest leverage situations every single time. But if they're all not going to get there until they prove otherwise. And I think it makes sense to defray it and just spread it out and not ask too much of any one pitcher. Be pleasantly surprised when they get the job done in easy fashion. And if they don't, then like you just avoid them the next time. And if I'm Will Venable and I'm throwing any of Wilson or Leisure or Boozer out there, I think you can defend it. And as long as you're not going the same well over and over again, because Leisure is now 1-for-4 in save opportunities and all of the save opportunities were legit. Like sometimes guys are like 1-for-7 in save opportunities, but the leads that they blew were in the seventh inning on an error and they were never going to get saved to begin with. So it's like, why even bother counting them as blown saves? But in this case, like Leisure was out there to save the game, get the final three outs and he didn't. So, yeah, I would, if I'm Venable, I think my first instinct is to try to not saddle somebody with the disappointment of blowing more saves than the average closer would. And then, you know, as long as you have credible major league relievers in the ninth inning, then I think you're probably doing most of the job, which is kind of sad to say. Given the state of the bullpen and how, you know, until like maybe Grant Taylor arrives, I don't know if there is that arm that's going to be somebody who makes the math a lot simpler in the back end.
I have a pedantic take.
Sure.
With the way that the game was sequenced at the start of the eighth, with the Rangers 1-2-3 coming up, I think Venable thought he was throwing Boozer into the highest leverage spot when he brought him in the eighth. And because if anybody gets on, he's gonna, one, he faces Wyatt Langford, who's, you know, probably the best hitter on the team. And if anyone like reached, he'd be facing a clean hitter too. That Boozer handled it so cleanly was why it looked like the equally tough assignment for Leisure anyway, on top of it just being the ninth. But I think he probably thought like, well, I'll definitely have Boozer facing a very difficult inning, or at least the most difficult inning. Whereas I'm not sure if that, if like it stretches out for another couple of hitters, it might be Leisure at the, against the bottom of the order. And so if he's picking one or the other at the start of the eighth, I could see how he looks at Boozer and thinks like, this is, I'm going with number one for what could be the toughest inning.
Yeah. I think you take it like three outs at a time. And then that's kind of what he said, is that, you know, he's not trying to get ahead of themselves. And I think like with the way the bullpen is constructed and how sketchy it is, like you can't take three outs for granted. So yeah, as long as he's got major league relievers, if he's not throwing Miguel Castro, just, you know, claiming him off somebody else, you know, or trading international pool money for somebody else's AAA reliever. And like, you're the closer now, like that would be insane. But guys who have been there either all season, you know, Wilson doesn't fit that description, but you know, they tendered him a contract. They traded for him. Like they thought he was going to be that guy. And he kind of looks like the guy now. He also fits that description. Like a healthy Fraser Ellard probably would fit that description of being a major league reliever. But you know, as it stands with just, nobody looking like a lockdown guy, then yeah, avoid pretending they are, which I think is what Venable is doing right now.
I get the decision, though. If Cam Boozer is your best reliever, we've talked about this for years, the ninth inning is not necessarily the most high leverage inning in a game. So I get that. It's just then there's not a dependable number two guy. But it is something that like other teams still manage their bullpen where, and we're going to see this in this upcoming series against the New York Mets, Edwin Diaz is the ninth inning guy. No matter where you are in the lineup, Diaz is coming in the ninth inning. Whoever hands the ball off to Diaz, that's up in the air in the seventh and eighth inning.
They just saved the game with Reed Garrett tonight, probably because they overused Diaz.
But Diaz has been used a lot.
I just want to do it. I guess like the logical like thing that really spices this up is like, if Grant Taylor's relieving anyway, why is he doing it over there?
It's a good question.
We're not really developing him to like creating this environment to build all of his arsenal and build his familiarity with starting that has lower consequences for not using it. I'm sure he'll get to it eventually. It's kind of like the same Elko at bats, you know, soon come, but you know, I wouldn't begrudge someone for thinking about it.
Well, we'll see if Grant Taylor does join the White Sox anytime soon. So that could be our new campaign, as Andrew Vaughn is now in Charlotte. We need something else to get the White Sox, encourage them to make some moves, make some actions.
On to the next conquest.
On to the next conquest. Thank you, James. Some highlights in this series. Joshua Palacios goes 3-for-8. Hits another home run. He's becoming Dwayne Wise right now. Alejandro Diaz-like as well.
Except he dropped a ball.
Yeah. He made up for it. He had a home run. Chase Mydroth, 12-game hitting streak. So he takes that to Queens. Mydroth continuing to hit for the White Sox as he's on a heater, batting well over 300 now in the month of May. The White Sox have 10 wins this month. That doubles the amount of wins that they had in the month of April. So May has gone a lot better for the White Sox than April. As I mentioned, the Chicago White Sox now head to Queens. They will be playing on Memorial Day, Monday at 3 o'clock. The New York Mets, 31-21 on the year. As we record this, they're wrapping up their game against the Los Angeles Dodgers. So they're going to be 2.5, maybe 3 games back of the Philadelphia Phillies in the National League East. In the last 10 games, the Mets have been struggling a little bit. They've been 4-6. Offensively, the Mets are not the offensive juggernaut that many expected. And a lot of that is on Juan Soto not having a blazing start to the first 50 games of the season. We'll talk about that in a moment. The Mets average 4.38 runs per game. Their team OPS is 9th in Major League Baseball. They have a team OPS of 734. They hit better at home. They have a team OPS of 759 at home. They've hit 55 home runs this year. That's good for 14th in Major League Baseball. On the pitching side, though, the Mets have been awesome. They have the best starter ERA in Major League Baseball at 2.89. The bullpen ERA, 2.87. That's third best in Major League Baseball. So the White Sox offense will be challenged in this series against the Mets. Your pitching probables, again, on Monday, Memorial Day at 3:10 p.m. Central Time. Adrian Hauser makes his second start for the White Sox against Clay Holmes. Tuesday and Wednesday, both of these games are at 6:10 p.m. Central Time. Shane Smith would get the call against Tyler McGill. And on Wednesday, Sean Burke will be going up against Griffin Canning. Unless James is right, it could be Jonathan Cannon instead of Sean Burke. So be flexible there, White Sox fans, and be ready for a change if that does happen. The White Sox have Thursday off before they head to Baltimore. We'll preview that weekend series against the Orioles in our next episode. That's going to be a fun series because there's something on the line between the Orioles and the White Sox this upcoming weekend. But first, the White Sox have to get through the Mets. And James, to borrow one of my favorite phrases in Star Wars, I've got a bad feeling about this. how can the White Sox fare? I guess what's your expectation of the White Sox faring against this New York Mets team that has been playing good baseball? They've been pitching very well, but offensively they can use a wake-up call, and boom, here come the White Sox.
Hope to take 1 out of 3. That would be good. Shane Smith is they're pretty much their best starter. The potential of Cannon, they're certainly built a bit more to win a 3-2, 4-3 game than they have in past years, based on, you'd hope, defense. But we just watched them, play 2 bad defensive games in a row. One of them going away, lost the other one because of it. I don't want to give excitement about this lineup, what their capabilities are, but I think there's something to it. They have a lot of guys who can work counts and work walks. Vargas seems a little, it's still hard to buy him as a middle of the order level power guy, but certainly is a legit bat in a way that I think is giving some stability that waiting on Luis and Andrew Vaughn to do something. Luis Robert is a 5 hitter is one step closer to what I think his ideal is, of just guy who comes up after the cluster of your lineup is gone, where either there's runners on bases or just a level of exhaustion where he gets something in the zone early in the count and whips on it. I feel like this puts him in a bit more position and less, center the entire offensive game plan around him. I was talking to Miguel the other day about, are you seeing kind of an adjustment with how you're being attacked? Because the whole thing you did was a correction against high velocity. And now they're hey, challenge him with a fastball is not a good idea. You'd think they'd stop challenging him pretty soon. And he was not very fazed by it. He's yeah, maybe a little, but nothing major. They still have to come in the zone at some point. and it's to his approach, which has always been pretty patient, like his at bat shouldn't just completely change shape because people know he has pop or people know that he's going to be able to hit a fastball. Like he was already like, whereas Lenin Sosa gets hot, like you see how the bats take a shape against him, where it's like, all right, let's spam him other batter's box sliders for a little bit and see how that goes. Vargas's has this stability to him that I think suits the middle of the order a bit more to just function or have consistent, you know, at bats where they get a runner on and they can put the ball in play and move him over, like at least create some sort of threat over the course of an inning a bit more. So all that to say, like, I could see some game where they win 4-3 behind one of their starters going good. And certainly if you have both Smith and Cannon coming up, you probably feel a bit better about seeing that happen at some point. Of course, the three games and, you know, not being mentioned as one of the sweeps going around the league, I think that'd be a good outcome for them. Then I think they can have, you know, a series against Baltimore where I don't want to say they have the advantage or anything, but certainly you can feel optimistic about them winning that series. And I think seeing a path to 3-3 every week for the White Sox, like, it's not like a fun thing to like talk about, but that's meaningful progress from last year. I think we all know that.
It is.
Even if, you know, the methodology from which they're getting there doesn't have, I think, as Jim will write about, that many young players to get hyped about. It's more like a small collection of projects rather than a full-blown youth movement. So I don't know if that takes away from it, but I think sometimes I read our comments and it seems like people would just like to watch decent baseball from now then, and the Sox providing incrementally higher portions of it.
Yeah, especially in the month of May. As I mentioned in the intro, the White Sox are on pace for 52 wins this year. That's an 11-win improvement if that does happen from last year. And I think for this weekend, for White Sox fans, that it's tough to follow what's happening around Major League Baseball. But for anyone that's been playing fantasy baseball or just keeping an ear to the ground when it comes to the national landscape, Jim, there's a lot of conversation about the slow start for Juan Soto. And Soto is struggling in his last seven games, which I think is just heightening this concern out of Queens. In his last seven games, Soto's just 4-for-28. And in his last 30 games, which spans 113 at-bats, Soto's just batting .221 with a .348 on-base percentage and slugging just .398. Even a .348 on-base percentage is well below par for Juan Soto, what he's been able to put together in his career. And when you look at his first 50 games with the Mets compared to his previous seasons, this is the worst start of Soto's career to a season. And now here come the White Sox. He's had tremendous success against the Chicago White Sox in his career. Do you think that this is the series that Juan Soto finally wakes up?
Maybe, like, when it comes to Soto's season, it reminds me a lot of like Francisco Lindor's first season with the Mets, and that, you know, gets traded, signs a big extension. Unimpressive, like he was kind of like an average or slightly above average player, provide like a lot, like he was durable. He was, you know, kind of an average bat, good glove, but, you know, missed some time, had a flare up with Jeff McNeil, I think that was that year. And so it's a case of, oh, is Mr. Smiles not Mr. Smiling? And, you know, all the tabloids take over. And then like 3 years later, he's great and getting MVP votes and fine. It looks like he's on a Hall of Fame path. And, you know, what was it all for? And so, like, with Juan Soto, kind of reminds me of the same thing. Like, you know, perhaps the contract puts a target on his back a little bit, and he has to get used to being like a fixture versus like a mercenary for the Yankees. Now he's the face of a team, and, you know, the Mets have to get used to him. He has to get used to the Mets, and, you know, by the end of the year or next year, everybody will forget that these were even really dumb storylines about, like, you know, whether or not he uses a private jet independent of the team. It all feels very Mets and New Yorkish, and just like looking for an opening to make
was
a big deal out of it, especially
that rumor. That rumor was true.
No, it was shot down. Like, I think Passan shot it down, but I heard about the rumor because I don't follow it that closely in terms of like what the New York Post is saying. But apparently, like, Passan shot it down. But and that's how I became aware of it, was the rejection of it by National Baseball Writers.
What a wild conspiracy to put out there. Have you ever heard of that, James? A player flying private?
It was like a misinterpretation. It was that like the team had arranged for private travel for his family, and people conflated that as like he had traveled privately with his family to the game, as opposed to like they had just blown his family out.
Yeah, so there's like a part of this whole, you know, like the New York ecosystem, fans, media, you know, WFAN, that's just ready for like, you know, any opening where they can say, oh, this guy is a prima donna, et cetera. So that's what it reminds me of, like Lindor being the same thing. And now he's fine. The talent won out at the end of the day. And so, like, I imagine Soto will be the same thing. So, you know, perhaps it's not an immediate turnaround. Could be, because he's a good hitter. White Sox have a lot of iffy pitchers. And so, like, that would be the way to get rights. But it does feel like more maybe of a half to full season project to finally be accepted as like, or get past the initial shock of the contract he signed for and spurning the Yankees, if that's a big deal, and all the drama that, you know, the New York environment seems to generate and feed off of and very cyclical. So that's why I'm maybe not, necessarily super scared by Juan Soto at this point versus last year when Grady Sizemore had to choose between like pitching to him or pitching to Aaron Judge, and both were Sizemore got ripped by a whole bunch of third party observers, and you're like, there wasn't a good choice. Soto right now is leading league in double plays, so perhaps he is a bit more pitchable than ever right now, and this is the time to face him. So those words could blow up my face, and you know, I would accept that, but there are signs that like not quite right yet, might need a little bit of time to fit in, but he will at some point.
Maybe the New York media should focus on the splits between day and night games. Maybe Juan Soto needs to have his vision checked when he's playing at night. This year, Soto has a 910 OPS. That's more on track for his career in day games. In night games, that drops to 693. That's a pretty significant change. He's batting 284 in day games, 205 at night, slugging 514 in the day, slugging just 350 at night. Let's see how this series goes. Maybe Soto has a big game on Monday, but if he's quiet on Tuesday and Wednesday, there you go, New York media. I gave you a new conspiracy. What if Juan Soto is not good at night? That's not true.
The unexciting storyline I'm looking at following the series is Griffin Canning, because he was somebody I was mildly interested in the White Sox signing, both because they do seem to have an interest in players the Angels don't quite handle well. Also, when I was looking at like Chris Flexen's stealth Cy Young, or sorry, Gold Glove case, not Cy Young case. That'd be a very stealthy Cy Young case. Really lying in the weeds there. But Gold Glove case, because of like the metrics are good and he was limiting stolen bases, and Canning ended up beating him out for one of the spots. And then looking at like how well Jonathan Cannon fielded position, Davis Martin isn't bad, and you know, like if they're not going to get strikeouts, then it's certainly behooves them to have some pitchers who make their lives simpler in other ways, like getting outs when they're available to them, either pickoffs or stolen base thrown out, or just handling every ball that's hit to him, every bunt that's hit to him. But Canning was one of those guys who, you know, he's looking to sign a one-year deal to get right. So the White Sox have innings for him. He's pretty durable. Why not? And end up going to Mets on a $4 million or so contract. And so, like, I'm curious now that he's pitching really well, he's got a sub-3 ERA. Still kind of the peripherals are all the same, so he's not suddenly striking guys out. But I'm curious to see like how he looks and just imagine what that might have looked like if the White Sox signed him instead of like Martin Perez to fill that same role.
I was having a casual conversation with a person in the White Sox dugout and made a comment about Soto, and they said something that was basically communicating what the pitching plan against Soto would be. And I think it's always a journalist's judgment call about what off-record stuff can be reported. But I imagine, as far as relationship maintenance, saying what the pitching plan against Soto right before the series on a podcast would be a violation of that. But I will be monitoring the series to see if we can discuss afterwards
Okay.
How it went. It seems like it would be different from what you saw them do unsuccessfully last time, but we'll have to see how it's
executed. I assume it's more complicated than like get strike one. get ahead in the count.
It's not that, but it's like not massively more complicated.
Okay.
Peter Alonso, who I think will be a free agent after this year, OPSing 927. He's having a big season, so that's the one hitter to watch out for.
Francisco, we're just talking about how the White Sox need to upgrade first base. Obviously, Pete Alonso in free
Thank
agency.
You, James, you shot down my Jake Berger idea. Berger had a big game on Sunday. Just want to point that out.
I mean, I think this would be funnier because obviously they wouldn't spend the money, whereas Berger, I think, you know. It obviously just makes sense from like put a decent player at the position. I just don't know if that's like, you know, the long-term goal. We'll see.
We'll see. Maybe Jerry Ryan Sarfield changes.
It'd be a big Sophie's choice for the fan base to choose between Jake Berger reunion or giving Tim Elko like a full-time job. Like they, there'd be, you know, I don't want to say divorces would happen because of it, but you know, you'll never know.
We'll be recapping this series on Thursday night. As our next podcast episode, I will be joined by Mike Farron, good friend of the show and good friend of the site. He's been broadcasting college baseball games on ESPN and has also a radio show on MLB Radio that you can check out on SiriusXM. He'll be joining me to preview the upcoming college baseball regionals as we are now officially on the road to Omaha, and a little bit more MLB draft talk. That'll be your next podcast episode. And then I'll be joined by James and Jim later in the week after the White Sox and Mets series concludes to recap what happens in Queens and look ahead to Baltimore as the battle for the American League's worst team will be on. The White Sox are within striking distance to pass the Baltimore Orioles. How exciting is that? Maybe we'll call up Dan Zaborski to join us, and he can share his anger at the Orioles of just how things have transpired in 2025. But before we wrap up this episode, as we usually do on the Monday shows, it's time to take a look around Major League Baseball. A couple of highlights, two Statcast records that were just broken over the weekend. O'Neill Cruz of the Pittsburgh Pirates hit a home run with an exit velocity of 122.9 miles per hour straight into the river outside PNC Park. A reminder, that will be our road trip this year in middle of July. So if you haven't gotten your tickets, you can definitely check that out at Sox Machine Store to purchase your tickets to join us in the group section and also the pregame party. But man, 122.9 miles per hour. And then Tarek Skubal had a Maddux, a complete game shutout below 100 pitches, only through 94. And he hit 102.9 miles per hour on one of those pitches, one of the fastest pitches ever. Actually, it is the fastest pitch ever by a starting pitcher in the StatCast era. So now Tarek Skubal could hit close to 103 miles per hour. That's a scary thought. And the Colorado Rockies on pace to win just 28 games this year. They're going to have to get on a heater to match the 2024 Chicago White Sox pace. It's getting ugly out there in Denver. So those are the big three highlights that I had for around Major League Baseball. James, I'll start with you. What is catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
I, like many people, I watch The Club or whatever the Red Sox documentary was. The Clubhouse was called. The Club was the 2010 White Sox documentary. There's obviously a lot of former Red Sox on the team, like Garrett Crow, or former White Sox on the Red Sox, Garrett Crochet, like having as good of a season as you can imagine so far from his start. You know, Lucas Giolito threw seven shutout innings on Saturday and the second half a doubleheader. Yeah, the Red Sox can absolutely not get right to a degree that baffles me to no end. Looks like they split with like Baltimore, which, you know, helped Baltimore stay ahead of the White Sox for not being the worst team in the American League. The lineup like looks more loaded than I can imagine like a White Sox lineup looking into the next 2 years, even without having a real first baseman, and they still struggle. It kind of speaks to one, they've had some like rotation injuries and instability, but they could really use a reliable bullpen. White Sox can't really help them out too much in that aspect in terms of what they can offer. I suppose I could send them like a picture of like Cam Boozer that says like "Miss me yet" or something like that. But they provide a lot of drama. They had like two of the three best prospects in the world and have only like not even called up like the highest, highly touted one yet. They seem like they should be a sleeping giant. They have so many resources. I don't know how they're a game under 500. They baffle me. I find them very entertaining. I think if you don't have any feelings about them, their fans should really just decide not care. Think about not caring about the Red Sox and see how much more they'd enjoy the product of its like constant weird machinations if they weren't emotionally tied to it. I know it's helped the last few years of the White Sox probably be a bit more easy for me to view than, you know, the average listener out there. So try it while still subscribing, of course.
Jim, how about you? What's catching your attention?
Well, yeah, along the same lines of what's already been mentioned, like Liam Hendricks kind of going through it, not toward the fan base, but just, you know, I guess, shining attention on the horrible comments you get when you mess up a high leverage situation, which I don't understand why pitchers, especially closers, how they have social media accounts to begin with, like how they do not just offload that to their agents, like never show me anything from this unless it's like either good news or just like would be a good story or, you know, heartwarming, et cetera. That's why I always thought Chris Sale was the smartest person alive for the way he just has no presence whatsoever on the internet. It's like, you know, good for him. But it doesn't seem he had a scoreless inning on Sunday. So perhaps that's, you know, some evening out and he'll kind of settle into a mid-leverage role. But stuff seems down. He's walking more guys than usual. He never walks anybody. So that kind of signals to me like he's got to be a lot more careful and he's not somebody ever since he's been in this form where he's been careful. Like he's just been ultra aggressive and that's how he wins and that's how he occasionally loses and that's what you get. And so a little bit worried for him as somebody who enjoyed his presence on the White Sox. You know, I want to see him do well, but it doesn't seem like a great mix for him right now. Also kind of reminding me that he's ever since he's achieved this form, like he's probably, you know, between Oakland and the White Sox, probably the two best fan bases for somebody like him. Like I think in terms of just like appreciating somebody who's very good and highly paid and, you know, accepts a character. I think, you know, A's fans loved him. White Sox fans, I think, are more inclined than other fan bases to like him and even and stand by him when things aren't going well. Whereas like the Red Sox, not so much when it's your first impression. So there's that. Also, like I was going to mention O'Neill Cruz even before he set the record, because like he's been torching the Brewers in a way that's very enjoyable. I think he's had like three hits, two homers, a triple, like all over 113 miles per hour, like 117 miles per hour. And there's something that's very satisfying just because of levers involved, being 6'7" and the bat speed. Like when he gets a hold of one, it's the kind of power that like makes me want to flip over a car and set it on fire. Just like there's something very primal and violent about it that just is so satisfying. And it reminded me that like when he broke his ankle under Sebi Zavala with that really awkward slide, like and it came at like a kind of a fragile moment of his career, like just starting out, like, are we going to be able to see the best O'Neill Cruz? And what a horrible way for it to turn if it's like against the White Sox and, you know, your career takes a turn for the worse with Sebi Zavala cursing at you because you almost injured him as much as he injured you. And to see him rebound, it's at a different position now. He's playing center field because, you know, the infield didn't quite work out, but like just seeing him be able to capture that power and also the speed, like he's like 18 for 19 stealing bases. He's something insane, like 40 for 42 or something like that over the past couple of years. So he's ultra efficient stealing bases, hits the bejesus out of the ball when he connects and the strikeouts start coming down. It seems a little bit to where he seems like he's back to being like the, I wouldn't call it appointment viewing, but he's somebody like if I'm looking at the game day or if I'm flipping around MLB TV and I see like his name's coming up, like I'll watch it at bat for the chance that he hits the ball in the river, which I think he did a couple times this series against the Brewers. So good for him. Glad to see that he's fully healthy. And just, yeah, I really enjoy the, you know, in a way like Jake Berger also hits the ball hard, but I think it's just like the levers involved, the 6'7" that just the distance the bat has to travel. And when it connects, I think it just adds that extra oomph that is really just ultra satisfying.
O'Neill Cruz this season, average exit velocity, 97 miles per hour.
Yeah, it's fun.
His bat speed averaging 78.9 miles per hour. Both metrics are in the 100th percentile in Major League Baseball. And again, we will see him in mid-July. July 18th to the 20th. Hopefully you join us out in Pittsburgh. We only have 8 tickets available. Again, go to the Sox Machine store to join us in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm hoping for at least one of those hits while we're in attendance. I want to hear it. Like, it's one thing to hear the microphones pick it up, but it sounds different in the park, I imagine. So I would like at least one 113 plus mile per hour
okay.
hit of some kind from Cruz just to understand what it's like.
Yeah, just not at somebody. Either that's on the field for the White Sox or a fan. Because when I heard the exit velocity, I'm like, I hope that was a home run into the bullpen. And then I watched the highlight and went in the river. I'm like, thank you. The yeah. Pirates have had enough.
It went through somebody's face and into the river.
Oh, gosh. Just kayaking like in San Francisco. What a beautiful day in Pittsburgh. Just this baseball coming at you. Yeah, that'd be
awful. Of the fish, Jeff.
The Pirates. Well, it's a fish. It'll be fine.
It was a fish.
the Pirates have had enough fan injuries for one season. So don't need to see that. But again, we hope to see you in Pittsburgh July 18th through the 20th. And that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can listen and watch the show as well and our other videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We're on Blue Sky at SoxMachine.com, JRFegan.SoxMachine.com and Josh.SoxMachine.com if you are pivoting over to Blue Sky. You can also sign up to become a subscriber on SoxMachine.com for $5 a month. That gets you ad-free version of both the podcast and website, full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, including the draft.
Yeah, and James has had some really great stories behind the paywall, exclusive subscribers. Mike Vassell being fueled by ABBA, which is cool. Or sorry, Bee Gees, yes. Yeah, 70s disco. You have great update on Kyle Teal. Also, one thing that was very enlightening to me was George Wolkow. The story about him like airing it out once he got a hit was awesome to read, just because that's what I do in MLB The Show. Like, as soon as I extend my hitting streak, then I hit the power swing. And if I strike out a couple times, don't care, because my hitting streak has reached like 87 games or whatever it is. So like, it's nice to see that, you know, even though he called himself immature for doing so and saying like, it's a way that he got out of his approach. And it's just like, oh, so you have that urge too, when you're actually in games, that like, once you get that hit and you're 1-for-4, you're 1-for, you're guaranteed at least 1-for-4 in the box score, that's when you start letting it fly. And so that was very a humanizing element to that story. So great for getting that quote.
You read it like, what do you mean immature?
No, I mean, like, yeah, they're just like us and all their ways. So yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Kyle Teal was just like us in the sense that he's trying to learn a new computer program at work.
Yep.
Well, you get
almost like the Declan Cronin of White Sox catchers, of just doing answering emails, administrative stuff on the side.
Again, you get full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, like Jim mentioned, on SoxMachine.com. Sign up. Monthly plan started at $5. We also have a couple spots in our Veterans Committee, which you can be part of our group chat and have direct access to both Jim and James. So James shares information and the gossip and whispers that he's hearing at the ballpark. If that interests you, go to SoxMachine.com.
Gripes.
The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.